Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The world powers are talking about the urgent need for a ceasefire. So, for example, in a strong and impassioned statement, the Jordanian king has condemned the recent Israeli attack on Palestine, expressing deep concern for the escalating violence and its devastating impact on innocent civilians.
Egypt holds a peace summit to find a solution to the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas.
I can say we were ready even before the campaign started. We understand that in Liberia, with the proliferation of political parties, it is extremely difficult for one party to clinch a victory on the first ballot.
Liberian opposition groups plan to unite ahead of the coming presidential election runoff.
Now they have signed law, 4 bills, which, according to the government, is going to radically change the issues of health in Kenya. But the problem is that it is going to place more burden on the already overburdened Kenyan citizen.
And Kenyans express displeasure with a new health measure that requires workers to contribute 2.75% of their salaries. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Egypt, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says a two-state solution will provide a fair and comprehensive answer to the Gaza crisis. He made the call at the Cairo Peace Summit, attended by leaders from Arab world, Europe, among others. The meeting comes amid fears the ongoing Gaza conflict could spread to other parts of the Middle East. It also comes as Israel prepares for a ground assault on Gaza following the October 7 attack by Hamas, which left 1,400 people dead. For the latest development, I reached reporter Angie Omar at the international meeting in Cairo.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi started the summit by strongly condemning Israeli attack on Palestine and vowed to prevent forced displacement of Palestinians. He declared that Egypt will not tolerate the forced displacement of Palestinians and emphasized the nation's unwavering commitment to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people during these hard times. The Egyptian president's condemnation came as the conflict between Israel and Palestine intensified, resulting in widespread destruction and loss of life. And his remarks actually reflected Egypt's firm stance against any form of aggression that threatens the safety and well-being of Palestinians.
Leaders who are present at the summit called for a ceasefire and for the humanitarian situation to be improved. Talk to me about how they dealt with this.
So the world powers are talking about the urgent need for a ceasefire. So, for example, in a strong and impassioned statement, the Jordanian king has condemned the recent Israeli attack on Palestine, expressing deep concern for the escalating violence and its devastating impact on innocent civilians. The king emphasized the urgent need for peace, not only for the people of Palestine, but also for the civilians in both Palestine and Israel. And in his address, the Jordanian king expressed his heartfelt condolences to the families of the victims. And he highlights the tragic loss of life and the immense suffering experienced by Palestinians. And the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas also said that he will not accept any form of displacement, and he reaffirmed their determination to stand firm on their land.
Angie, what did the leaders talk about regarding a political solution to the ongoing conflict?
So the summit, the leaders did focus on primary objectives. One of the main objectives of the summit and of what the leaders are talking about is to secure a comprehensive and lasting ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. This would involve a cessation of hostilities, the cessation of rocket attacks and airstrikes, and the establishment of mechanisms to monitor and enforce the ceasefire agreement. The summit also addressed the dire humanitarian situation in the Palestinian territory, particularly in Gaza, which has been affected by the conflict. Discussion did actually revolve around the urgent need for humanitarian aid, access for essential services such as healthcare and education, and the reconstruction and development of infrastructure. And the summit also explored avenues for advancing political solutions to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This involved discussions on the resumption of meaningful negotiations, the adherence to the international law and relevant UN resolutions, and the commitment to a two-state solution that ensures the establishment of an independent, civilian, and viable Palestinian state alongside Israel. The summit did also address the internal Palestinian political dynamics and the need for reconciliation and unity among various Palestinian factions. Discussions did focus on fostering unity among Palestinian leadership and establishing a common vision and strategy to advance the Palestinian cause and negotiate with Israel.
Angie Omar is a reporter attending the Cairo Peace Summit. She spoke with me from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Violent clashes broke out on Friday between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians in the city of Ramallah in the West Bank. VOA's Yann Bouchard was there and has this report from the scene.
Hi, I'm Yann Bouchard. I'm here in Ramallah, and another day of clashes here in the West Bank. At this point here, at least five people were shot today. And another shot right now. Another guy just got hit. See, the Israeli soldiers are very close to here, and they're shooting live ammunition. Another guy seems to be hit now. I saw at least five people being hit. Maybe this is the sixth victim. Most of them were hit in the legs, but at least one guy I can see was hit in his stomach. This is an ongoing situation, and there's a lot of tension here, of course, because there's an expectation that the violence could come to this area, and here in the West Bank, situation is too calm compared to Gaza, but nobody knows that. Can happen soon. I'm Yann Bouchard for VOA News from Ramallah.
In Liberia, the main opposition Unity Party plans to collaborate with other opposition groups ahead of the coming presidential runoff election. Mohamed Ali, the general secretary of the Unity Party, says the presidential election results show that a majority of Liberians do not want incumbent President George Weah to run the affairs of the West African country. His remarks comes after results announced by the National Electoral Commission show that with 99.3% of the total vote cast, Weah had 43.84%, while main challenger Joseph Boakai came in second with 43.44%. Mohamed Ali, the general secretary of the Unity Party, tells me that opposition groups are determined to work together to wrest power from the president.
I can say we were ready even before the campaign started. We understand that in Liberia, with the proliferation of political parties, it is extremely difficult for one party to clinch a victory on the first ballot. And so we had everything in place and anticipated a runoff just in case. So yes, we are absolutely prepared once the Elections Commission announces the final results and open campaign. We are on the wheels and moving throughout the length and breadth of Liberia.
Are there plans of joining other opposition parties to boost your chances?
Well, Peter, if you didn't win it in the first round, it means that you have to collaborate with other political parties in order to get it in the runoff. We have already other political parties collaborating with us. And even before we could go into the first round election, a presidential candidate has already endorsed us. So, yes, we are now reaching out to presidential candidates, to legislative candidates, to other political parties, in order to get their support, because that is how we are going to win. But also, we are going to reach out to the people. We are going to reach out in the communities.
But, Mohammed, some people are suggesting that President Weah, the incumbent, could do the same. With the power of incumbency at his disposal, he could easily sway people to his side.
Well, in the campaign, but in the first round, the message was clear from the opposition bloc. We want President Weah out. That was the message. We may not have gone as a single unit in the first round, but the overarching objective of the opposition bloc is that we want to get President Weah out. And 56% voted against President Weah. Those who voted against him, they want him out. And they will find the alternative in Ambassador Joseph Boakai, the former vice president, and the Unity Party, and they will join us. And that's why we're talking to them. We do not have an issue with our colleagues in the opposition. They have a single objective. And once that objective is genuine and we can work together, trust me, they will come on board and President Weah will be history by January.
Aren't you being complacent on this?
If we were complacent, we would not talk about reaching out. We are strategizing. We are reaching out more vigorously than we did in the first round. We are going to campaign more vigorously than we did in the first round because we understand that we have to take our message around. We have to convince the people who didn't vote for us. We still have to stick with the people who voted for us. So that means we have to increase our voting base in order to clinch this. There can be no complacency. And if we were to make that mistake, which is unthinkable, it means that we are out. So complacency is not anywhere around us. It's not in our dictionary.
Mohammed, ahead of the elections, a lot of opposition parties, including yours, expressed concern about voter irregularities and possible rigging. Both local and international poll observers said the elections were held in a transparent manner and a peaceful manner. Your critics are saying that you made a mountain out of a molehill and you have been proving to be false, accusing the ruling party of going to rig the elections, and it did not happen like you had anticipated. So what is your assessment of the just-ended election?
You know, Peter, you see, in Liberia, rigging elections does not happen when they are announcing the votes. Anyone who does that, they do it recklessly. There are several ways through which you can rig elections. Number one, the ruling party had unhindered access to state resources, which they used to their advantage. That is out of law. Even the AU, the EU election observer missions, they all stated that very clearly. The second thing they did with state resources is to use money to buy voter cards from areas that are deemed stronghold for the opposition, and they are still starting that. The next thing is the observer missions do not have the chance to go throughout the interior of the country. As we speak, there are reports that ballot papers were marked, that they overhyped the turnout in the southeast, that gave President Weah an unprecedented level of votes from the southeast. And you know, I spoke with EU observer. They asked this question. I asked them, are you going everywhere? Are you going to observe the polls everywhere? They said, no, we'll be in the urban area. And I said, that is your problem.
Mohammed Ali is the general secretary of the Unity Party. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
The government is to set up a committee that will look at the just concluded 2023 elections with the aim at zeroing in on polling, tallying, result management, the processes, procedures.
Meanwhile, in Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says it expects negotiators to brief the party for a consensus to be reached following a deal with the government to ease political tensions. Mediated by the ECOWAS, a regional bloc, and the African Union, the talks between the government and the APC struck a deal that will see the opposition party end its boycott of parliament. It also leads to the release of political detainees and politically motivated legal cases. For more reaction, I reach Sidi Yaya Tunis. He is the spokesperson of the main opposition APC. Apologies. In Uganda, a suspended member of parliament says he is committed to pushing back against intimidation, human rights abuse, and harassment of opposition. Francis Zaki, a leading member of the National Unity Platform, NUP, says his suspension is wrong and an affront to democracy. The parliamentarian and four other lawmakers, who are all from the opposition, were suspended over disciplinary issues by the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Thomas Tayebwa. The lawmakers are scheduled to return to the legislature next week. I reach parliamentarian Francis Zaki for more reaction to their suspension.
So, it was very, very, very unfair of the presiding officer, of the Speaker of Parliament at that time, to suspend only the five of us. It was unjustifiable because even just recently, last week on Thursday, when the matter touching my name was brought in the House, it was brought in an rowdy way. So first and foremost, the reason of suspension was unjustifiable. They never gave the reason as to why the five members of parliament were suspended. Up to now, we can't access parliament. We can't access, you know, the principles of parliament. We can't access the compound. We can't even get near parliament because they have put security. Actually, they went ahead to put security all over parliament, even within the debating area. People armed with rifles, armed with the kind with pistols and whatsoever, to the extent that even today, the parliament went on without media, without cameras, without anything live being recorded.
But your critics are saying you are a rabble-rouser and you are the cause of destabilizing parliament. And that is why the four others who were supporting you were suspended, because you are the leader of the rabble-rousers in parliament.
Actually, I'll turn it against the presiding officer. The presiding officer cannot manage to preside over the House. Whenever people get rowdy, how do you manage them? This is a speaker who has no integrity. This is a speaker who overturns his own decisions. Remember, Peter, or the Court of Appeal in Uganda, the Constitutional Court, ruled in my matter that I took to court, that Parliament doesn't follow its own rules of procedure. We violate our rules in Parliament. And who does that? It is the Speaker of Parliament. It is the Speaker of Parliament that has turned Parliament into a market. It is the Speaker of Parliament that has turned us rowdy. Because as a Speaker, you must have the authority and powers to have your house in order.
I understand the Speaker at that time, the Deputy Speaker, Mr. Tayebwa, had no choice than to suspend the five of you for disciplinary issues and bringing chaos and disrepute to the August House of Parliament of Uganda.
Now, that's why I'm telling you that gets me to the point of dictatorship. The Speaker of Parliament, even the deputy, they don't follow any rule of law of that parliament to base on when they're making decisions. When you're suspending MPs, you must have a basis. When you're saying that someone is indisciplined, you must make sure that you catch the eye of everyone whom you think is indisciplined, because you cannot leave the MPs belonging to the government, the MPs of NRM, they are resisting all that is happening in parliament, and you leave them free. And then when the opposition does the same thing that the government have done, and then you leave them to go out scot-free. That is not democracy.
The five of you say you are going to continue with the fight against intimidation. Are you being intimidated in parliament? Because you are all equal in parliament. So what is the intimidation that you are talking about?
Not only the intimidation, the threats. I told you, members of parliament belonging on the side of government, they didn't want me to speak in parliament. You saw that happening. Secondly, you saw members of parliament belonging on the side of the government intimidating and threatening to beat me up and undress me. Didn't you hear that, Peter? It was happening. Were they touched? Were they suspended? Were they sent to the disciplinary committee? No, it was never done. But they came into the house and the house was adjourned prematurely and was never justifiable at all. So, do you want us to work in such an environment? We cannot allow that.
I hear next week that is when the suspension elapses. When you go back to parliament, what are you going to do next?
Just like our fellow members of parliament who were not suspended, today you've seen what they have done. They have actually begun from where we stopped yesterday. immediately, even us, the people who have been suspended, the five of us, immediately we return. We shall begin from where our fellow colleagues stopped from. That's where we shall begin from. Because now, even today, has it been Zaka? I've not been in the house. Has it been Zaka that has led the people, to the fellow members of parliament, to get out of the house? Is it me? Of course, no.
Francis Zaake is a member of the Ugandan parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says it expects negotiators to brief the party for a consensus to be reached following a deal with the government to ease political tensions. Mediated by the ECOWAS, a regional bloc, and the African Union, the talks between the government and the APC struck a deal that will see the opposition party end its boycott of parliament. It also leads to the release of political detainees and politically motivated legal cases. For more reaction, I read Sidi Yaya Tunis. He is the spokesperson of the main opposition APC.
The government is to set up a committee that will look at the just concluded 2023 elections with the aim at zeroing in on polling, tallying, result management, the processes, procedures, and even the legal framework, which is key because, I mean, the disaggregated result was the key demand for the APC going into this dialogue. So if that is not forthcoming, the setting up of committee could lead us into getting the truth as to what really transpired during the elections as far as it relates to results. But in addition, the release of all political detainees, the also resettlement of politically displaced people locally and internationally as a result of political harassment, intimidation, are all part of the agreement.
You talked about the government setting up an entity to look into certain aspects of the concerns that you've raised. What will the APC do as part of this negotiations and the deal struck?
Well, in the first place, according to the agreement that was brought to us by those who represented us in the dialogue, His Excellency the President is to deliver a statement addressing the key issues in this agreement and setting up the framework for implementation of those key issues. And then, yes, the agreement also states that the APC will have its elected officials take up offices and participate in governance at parliamentary and local council levels. And also, this committee that is to be set up will have a joint leadership, a tripartite leadership, the government, the APC, and the development partners to ensure that the committee really carries out the mandate as per the terms of reference that will have to be developed jointly by the government and the APC.
Is the APC pleased with the agreement so far reached?
Even though the people who took part in the dialogue were sent by the party, I have to state that the party was represented at the highest level. But they will have to report again to the party as to the outcome of the dialogue so that we can all have consensus as to the implementation of the dialogue itself. At this stage, it is always difficult for you to have 100% satisfaction from any dialogue. So I can't say that, you know, it is with the assurances or with the nod of every single member of the party as to what really went on during the dialogue.
Do you think with this agreement reached or struck will ease the political tension in Sierra Leone?
Well, it will all depend on the sincerity and the good faith in implementing the agreement itself. Clearly, if we are able to review our political system in a manner in which the terms of reference will speak to unearthing the irregularities of June 24, 2023 elections, as well as other elections before that, but particularly the June 24, 2023 elections, it will help us a long way into addressing elections irregularities and guaranteeing the credibility, the freeness, and the fairness of future elections in this country, which I believe is the ultimate and most important demand the APC has been making and will continue to make, and which majority of the people of this country are interested in. So it must be done in a very sincere manner. The agreement will have to be implemented in an honest and sincere manner. And I hope and pray that the moral guarantors will continue to stay on top of this. Clearly, as I speak, you have so many people languishing in jail. You have people who lost family members, whose family members were killed. People need to be investigated and brought to book. Those who were involved in the killings should be investigated and brought to book. Those who lost family members, we should have an end to how their family members lost their lives. These are not things that we should just sweep under the carpet.
Sidi Yaya Tunis is a spokesperson for the main opposition, the All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. In Kenya, a new health measure that requires workers to contribute 2.75% of their salaries is generating opposition from civil society and independent employers. The government says the legislation will promote universal health care that's more affordable and accessible. But the opposition says it is a new tax which will worsen the economic conditions for Kenyans. This after Parliament passed the new social health insurance bill. James Mwamu, a former president of the Law Association of Kenya, tells me that a new measure will add to the economic hardship of workers.
Now they have signed into law four bills, which according to the government is going to radically change the issues of health in Kenya. But the problem is that it is going to place more burden on the already overburdened Kenyan citizen who has now had to contend with the issues of taxation, increased and rising cost of petrol, the increase in rising of foodstuffs, and those other things. So it is going to injure a lot of ordinary Kenyan citizens, which is not a good thing, according to even the health experts and also financial experts.
But James, the government says that the requirement of the 2.75% of their salaries toward a new health fund will make it more affordable and accessible for poor Kenyans. But why are Kenyans not seeing it from the government's perspective, since they argue that this is controversial?
If you look at the pay slip of a normal civil servant, you have deductions for pay as you earn. You have deductions from now the introduced 2% for the housing fund. You have the deduction for other other government requirements and other government taxes. You know, you can only make it affordable if the guy is able to eat. Now, you can only go and look for health and be helped if you are eating well. Now, if your salary is overburdened with all those deductions and at the end of the day you have nothing, it does not matter whether you go to hospital. An angry man going to hospital is going to die of anger. So in fact, he's not even worried about sickness. He's worried about what he's going to eat. This is why the most of civil servants and the people who are in private sector are complaining.
Why does a section of the population think that this health care fund will be beset by corruption?
Because, you know, but that does not even need any amplification or substantiation. Because even the NHIF fund, they reported that I think 7.5 billion was paid to ghost hospitals, they were paying to ghost patients, they were paid to all manner of funny people. So And the money has gotten lost from, even from the current NHIA. If they expand it, with the history of corruption in our country, in both health sector and other sectors, this is why Kenyans fear that it is just going to be another conduit for the big boys to be eating money, and it is, there's not going to be good value or good returns for this particular deduction. So this is why Kenyans are worried. The cost of living is high. There is no genuine effort to fight corruption. So this money is likely to go into some other holes, you know, that are going to benefit other people, a small amount of group of people other than the ordinary citizen of the Republic of Kenya.
Employers who are required to match their employees' contributions also appear to be opposing the 2.75% deduction as too high. You think their stance is just justifiable?
It is justifiable. You see, like now, we pay NHIF for our employees. You know, we also make a contribution. But you see, when the contribution is that high, you know, what the employer is going to do is to deduct from the salary of the employee. And that is not fair, because you see, the cost of living has risen. Now, when you are making a further deduction to the salary of an employee, it means that you are oppressing the fellow or the folk father, which is not very fair. Already, the employers, both in the private sector and the public service, is saying, no, this is not the right way to go. You know, you should allow for the economy to normalize, then begin to introduce these changes. We are going to radically affect the ordinary worker. You know, the guy in their normal parlance, they call the hustler, you know. It is going to affect them adversely and very, very badly. You know, so employers are justified in complaining, because they will have to cough. They're already paying taxes, they're paying housing, levy, you know, and all sorts of levies. So this is, the employers are right to complain.
James Mwamu is a former president of the Law Society of Kenya. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Human Rights Watch is expressing concern that Chadian authorities have yet to investigate human rights violations during a nationwide protest last year. In a newly released report, the group also called for an independent inquiry into the violations and to hold accountable those responsible. This after opposition groups accused authorities of tightening political space and making it difficult for opponents to freely operate ahead of the much-anticipated constitutional referendum scheduled for later this year. To learn more about the report, I reached Louise Mudge. He is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch.
To date, we still don't know exactly how many people were killed. The government has one number, which is around 50. But independent organizations and, more importantly, the National Human Rights Commission have come up with much higher numbers, well over 100, even as close to 150 killed. And to date, there's just been no investigation. There's been no accountability. The fact that 1 year later, despite some you know, real efforts by some actors to push for some degree of accountability, there's been nothing, and it really reflects a worrying trend in Chad that nobody will be held accountable for these really horrific killings in the capital and the hundreds and hundreds of people who were shipped up to the Sahara Desert, to Korotoro prison, who were detained there, many of them detained unlawfully and subject to torture. Who then subsequently were released. There's just been no accountability whatsoever for these abuses.
Opposition supporters have also said that the human rights violations are still going on. The Transformer Party recently accused the authorities of arresting supporters who wanted to protest, and that the leaders of the party have been prevented so far from going into the country. Is this a trend?
Yeah, it is. It is following a trend, and what I can say is that 1 year on from this horrific day in Chad, we are seeing the political space in the country continue to close, and this is very worrying. As you've just said, it's been over well over a week now that 72 members of the Transformers, or as they're known in French, the Transformateurs Party, have been held in the intelligence services office. Highly unusual, very worrying. And as of my most recent conversation with N'Djamena last night, they're still not getting access to their lawyers. At the same time, again, as you've alluded to, the president of the Transformer Party, his name is Suse Masra, he's not been able to travel back to Chad in advance of a constitutional referendum, which is coming at the end of the year. As he announced, he was returning to Chad. An international arrest warrant from Chadian authorities was leaked on social media, alleging very serious crimes. And then there was a statement by the government, an effort by the government to try to make sure airlines won't bring him back into the country. So real efforts in the last few weeks to really close this political space and not enable Chadians to have the opportunity to move forward towards this constitutional referendum in an open political space.
Supporters of the authorities are saying that some of these opposition groups are trying to undermine social cohesion, trying to undermine the territorial integrity of Chad, and that those who break the law must be punished, must be made to face the full force of the law. Do you think the latest human rights report would put pressure on the authorities in N'Djamena to investigate and prosecute those responsible for their atrocities committed?
That's certainly our hope. Our hope is that continued reports by groups like Human Rights Watch, groups like Amnesty, will put some pressure on the Chadians to take seriously this issue of accountability. But to your earlier point about some of these people being sort of real criminals, the facts of this: when President Deby died on the battlefield in 2021, the Chadian Constitution had a very clear provision enabling a political transition over the course of several months to happen to elect a new head of state. That constitution was effectively thrown into the bin. They instead suspended the constitution, put in place a military transition, and we are still seeing the effects of that military transition and its crackdown on civil society and political opponents and the media. The people who are calling for justice, in Human Rights Watch's opinion, we've not seen any evidence that they're trying to overturn the government, have a violent overthrow of power, or attack the integrity of the state. On the contrary, what we're seeing them try to do is bring in a degree of civilian rule into Chad and not be ruled once again by a military junta. And as we approach the constitutional referendum for a new constitution, which will enable Deby's son to run for president in December, I think it's really important that those voices who really want civilian rule are heard. So we're really hoping that the Chadian government will at least allow those voices to be heard in N'Djamena and other cities across Chad.
Luis Marge is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from New York. In Mozambique, lawmakers from the main opposition party, RENAMO, say they will continue to boycott parliamentary activities until the recent municipal elections are reorganized. The move is also backed by other opposition groups in the legislature. This after rejecting the outcome of the local elections, saying they were fraught with irregularities and a lack of transparency. Supporters of RENAMO demonstrated early this week after the ruling party FRELIMO was declared winner in most municipalities. For more reaction about the polls and the decision to boycott parliament, I reach Mohamed Yassin. He is a member of the Mozambican parliament from the opposition party RENAMO.
We went to these elections knowing that the election would be rigged. First, because when we started registration for the people that allowed to vote, it was clear that the regions where the opposition have a majority of voters, the registration was very weak and badly prepared. And that was a first sign that something is going to happen. Yes, the elections were rigged, and it's no longer the leader of RENAMO who says so, but the court. As you know, in Maputo, in Kilimane, and in Nampula, and the Shiuri, the court issued positions saying that most of the elections were rigged. Most of the places where elections took place were actually the results were tampered.
So does that mean that the RENAMU wants re-election to be organized by the Electoral Commission?
Yeah, but actually this is the new order of the court saying that the elections, they need to be new elections in the country. In the same position of the President Chissano, the former president says that there are a lot of irregularities on these elections. So if we don't have a clear and clean winner, we need to be mature enough to avoid internal conflicts and decide to go for new elections. But we've been saying that since last year, that Frelimo is planning to rig the upcoming elections. And the result is what we see today.
So you think you are vindicated by your suggestion?
Yeah, of course. And the proof, we have a lot of proof that, okay, this election was rigged. And what it gives us comfort is the position of the court. The court now, the cases that we have taken to court, we came clear. We won those cases that we took to the court. It's clear that Frelimo did not win those elections, especially in Maputo. And now in Nampula, the court actually saying the same. So the point what I'm saying is that we may play a political position, but we need also to look at the impact of this type of actions into the people. Now we have four people that have been killed by police in Shiuri. How many more people we need to see them dying in order to say that we need to change the way we do elections in Mozambique? Why can we not have electronic voting? Why is it that the Frelimo is not accepting?
But people are saying the electronic voting, you don't have the infrastructure to support the electronic voting that RENAMU is talking about. And some people are also suggesting that if you suggest or you anticipated rigging, why do you participate in an election planned to be rigged in the first place?
Remember, in 2009, RENAMU said that the election would be rigged and did not participate, even though being the second major larger party, the election took place. It's better to remember we had an example. Before, we said this election is going to be rigged. But Frelimo went through the elections and they won almost everywhere. It means that democracy in Mozambique is still a child. It does not mean that if RENAMU does not participate, Frelimo will not win elections. Frelimo will still do the elections and they will call it a fair and just elections.
So you have joined other opposition parties to boycott any form of participation of governance until the elections are rerun.
Exactly. That's what we do. Because it doesn't make sense. For example, the court is saying that we need to rerun election in certain places. We're saying no. It's everywhere. Even the places where RENAMU won, you need to rerun election because they were tampered. Look, we have a place where RENAMU won elections, but the government did not give a chance RENAMU to govern that places. But the results are clear. So how can we not call for new elections in a situation like this? And remember, we have next year general elections. And this is actually a sign of what Frelimo is preparing for next year.
Mohamed Yassin is a member of the Mozambican Parliament from the opposition party RENAMU. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has launched the Border Management Authority, or BMA, aimed at combating cross-border crime. The new institution now becomes the country's third law enforcement organization. The new security organization, the president says, is designed to tackle challenges including congestion, procedural delays, long transit times, lack of predictability, and the high cost of logistics experienced at a number of ports of entry. Dr. Michael Masiapato is the commissioner of the BMA. He tells me that South Africa now has an integrated border management platform with a single command and control to support secure borders, ensure safe travel, and facilitate trade.
So over 30 years of implementing a multi-agency approach, it became clear that it has brought to us a number of challenges. And most of those challenges are embedded on fragmentation. They are embedded on issues of silos. But it also creates this whole environment of facilitating corruption. Because we have a number of people in an environment where there is not a single authority that is accountable for the space. So that on its own also creates too much of bureaucratic processes in the port of entry. So that had created a lot of challenge for us. And that is why when we looked at the whole thing, we also realized that there is a serious underutilization of resources. So that is why there was a discussion which took almost 15 years in the country to say that we need to integrate all these functions at the port of entry and create a single authority, which will then be responsible for implementing border laws across all these streams of work. There must be a single commander who is accountable for the work of border management in the Republic.
Well, Commissioner, talking about corruption and bureaucracy, like you mentioned, skeptics say this will not work because the system has been corrupted so much so that you won't be able to fully manage who comes in and who goes out legally. What say you?
Now, if somebody will say an integrated model would not have some kind of traction, that wouldn't necessarily be accurate. The issue of an integrated border management is not just a good idea from the internet. It is actually applied by other jurisdictions out there. And we have seen the kind of benefits that it brings. Now, if we are to talk about corruption or to talk about people facilitating people illegally, I can also indicate this point that once you integrate all of these functions, you then deploy technology to be able to streamline the processes under a very intensive technology-driven model. In that way, the involvement of individuals becomes very much structured, and there is no any haphazardness in the way they do things. That on its own already brings some aspect or element of order in the environment. And ultimately, that will assist us in terms of dealing with issues of corruption.
Now, let me ask you this, because some South Africans that I spoke with talked to me about this will add additional bureaucracy and increase the budget, because they think that service delivery is not as great, and they have been complaining about it, and they're forming this new border organization. They don't see it as in good taste. How do you convince them that this is the right way to go?
You see, the issue of border management authority haven't been discussed in the Republic for over 15 years. It is something that has been discussed by selected people, meaning most of those were people in the bureaucratic space or in the technocratic space in the state, but not necessarily that much publicly. So if you might have had some conversation with some South Africans, I suspect they might not necessarily be understanding the model. There are people who think that the Border Management Authority is an addition to a number of structures that are at the port of entry. If that was the case, I would definitely, in a way, agree with them. But in this instance, that is not the case. What the Border Management Authority model does, we do away with a multiple departments on the ground. They literally leave. They are no longer going to be operating at the port of entry. But instead, the Border Management Authority takes over those functions, and we then do them as a single authority with a single command and control. Now, one of the key aspects that comes with this kind of a model, it is the process through which we are then able to say the player and the referee are now no longer one individual. If you were to look at the initial model, you have a Department of Home Affairs, which basically develop the policies, they develop in the laws, but they must go out there on the ground and try to deal with those. That is why they were able to operate on the ground and easily subvert the system. Because it is the same person who is actually designing this, you go on the ground and you ultimately implement. And that is why they could easily subvert the system. But when you have a separated model, what it does is it says the Department of Home Affairs in South Africa will still be the one that makes determination which country or which people from which country needs to enter the country with visas or not.
Dr. Michael Masiapato is the commissioner of the newly created Border Management Authority, or BMA. He spoke with me via Skype from Johannesburg, South Africa. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spread from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from African collection. That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impulga and engineer Peter Hanley, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, nobody can prepare for the Harmattan by drinking plenty of water. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.